Well, welcome everybody to this event organised by the Better Government Initiative. You will probably all know that the BGI was set up in response to a book by Sir Christopher Foster, published in 2005, now I think going into paperback, isn't it, Christopher? Perhaps it already has. Called the Crisis in British Government. The BGI is mainly composes former senior civil servants, not all, I was saying to Dominic, near death, like Richard and me, but in fact some only recently retired,
and,
but who have been round all these tracks before. And we try to make our advice available in a way of which, of course, our colleagues currently in the civil service can't do publicly, by blogs and putting them on the website and so on a variety of subjects. And the document you've got today is about avoiding the omnishambles, of just a sort of rather dramatic name, when a new government comes into power after the election. And, of course, the risk of omnishambles is made more acute by the absurd way in which we form governments in Britain after an election within 24 hours, very often, when all the politicians are about as exhausted as they possibly can be and haven't had an opportunity to think for the previous 5 or 6 weeks what it is that they're going to do. And so we who have seen these processes at close quarters have seen many mistakes made. So that is the purpose of the document we've produced here. It is our advice to, and of course it will be the main parties who will take the lead in forming the next government, and we're very fortunate to have Charlie Faulkner and Dominic Grieve, two very senior and distinguished members of the Labour and Conservative parties, to respond to what's in our paper, which I'll ask Richard to introduce.
Thank you very, very much. I'll stand up, actually, for, and I want to be as brief as possible. So although this is what is in the paper, I'm not going to go through it bit by bit and in that order. What I thought I'd do is I'd just reflect on some of the issues and through doing that, I bring out some of the points that we're very, very concerned about. And I thought I'd begin by, Robin touched on the point about omnishambles. I was saying to Dominic, I mean, the interesting thing about the word omnishambles, which is now a sort of generic, is it was once a very particular context, and the particular context was a television programme called The Thick of It. And the word was coined by and used by Malcolm Tucker in the third series of The Thick of It, and from that point onwards, it sort of took off. And by 2012, it was the word of the year, I think, in the Oxford English Dictionary. But the reason why I think this is important is because some of us might think, and I'll come back to this, that omnishambles has an association with a certain style of government. So just as, and I've made this point to some people before, just as, you know, the Yes Minister is both a sort of a comedy and a satire and also a documentary, The Thick of It is a comedy, a satire and a documentary about a later version of government. And the interesting question for us all, I think, is that later version of government what we want? And indeed, do we want to take that later version of government a little bit further? There's two other points, preliminary points I wanted to put on the table. One is, it's very curious, I think, when one looks at the debate that we're having about the nature of government and issues around quite small processy things, to wonder whether this debate is really appropriate given the scale of the responsibilities of government. If you compare the political rhetoric and then you read the whole of government accounts, which I've actually done because I'm a very sad person, you begin to wonder whether we exist on two planets, really. And similarly, a lot of the discussion about government, I think, completely misunderstands, misrepresents, fails to appreciate both its complexity and its scale. So for many years, I worked in the Ministry of Defence. I was once the permanent secretary of the Ministry of Defence when it was solvent. And even now, the Ministry of Defence, one major government department, has the scale and breadth of responsibility of a FTSE 100, sort of top five FTSE 100 company. And yet a lot of the discussion we have implies that a small number of people sitting in the centre of government could run the whole thing, including these huge, huge organisations. It's got, for instance, 2.5 times as many people as Royal Dutch Shell and is a much more complex organisation. So I think we need to appreciate scale. Then I think we need to ask ourselves, and it's very helpful that we've got Tony King in the room, actually, we need to ask ourselves, if we looked at the various case studies of shambles of various kinds, what lessons would we draw? And are the lessons that are being drawn the lessons that flow from actually, if you look in depth, at why things have gone wrong? And I think I'd argue they're not always. So what we actually have is a situation where, in my view, we have problems inside government because we have too much groupthink, we have not enough integration of policy development and implementation, we have politically driven timetables which are unachievable, we have a lack of expertise both in amongst ministers and civil servants and special advisers given the weight of their responsibilities, we have insufficient continuity in ministerial and official appointments. And we lack some of the things that you see in any other large organization. I'm involved with quite a large company. It's quite striking to see the contrast between the way that company works and some of the ways in which government works. That company actually has quite a lot of clarity over who is responsible for what and lines of authority and who can sign off an investment and so on. It has high levels of trust and mutual respect amongst the people who work there. It has alignment all up and down the organization between people at different levels to try and understand and appreciate and share their goals, and it has a massive focus on talent management. And you might ask yourselves whether that is what would come to your minds if you thought about the British government. So against that background, some of the things that we want to bring out are as follows. If we start with running a government, what we say in the report is a number of things which are at one level pretty obvious, at another level not always followed. Success depends on the team effort, as I said, on sort of mutual trust and cooperation between ministers inside departments as well as across departments. And that sort of success is actually the antithesis of the sort of in-the-thick-of-it style of government. You need the right relationship between the centre and departments, and that relationship needs to recognise that what the centre is supposed to do is look from the top down in the way only the centre can think about problems and think strategically. What it's not required to do or capable of doing is micromanaging all the bits of government, but that's where it tends to revert to if you're not too careful. We need to recognise that nearly all big issues in government are interconnected, cross-departmental boundaries. We need to look at these issues in clusters. There are all sorts of ways we could do this more imaginatively. We could look, for instance, you know, what's done in New Zealand and so on and so forth. We could look at extending what both the present government and the previous government have done in terms of ministers with more responsibility in more than one department and so on. Look at shared budgets, etc. We should have a focus on an effective policy-making machinery, which is evidence-based policy, not policy-based evidence. Look at some of it and ask yourself which way around it goes. We should avoid extensive machinery of government changes. In fact, we should avoid all machinery of government changes which are simply for political signalling and only adopt those where there's a driving purpose that relates to improving service to the citizen or the way we think about policy. And I think the Institute for Government has made this point. You know that the best example of this is another department I was permanent secretary of. I don't know why it is that I just follow success. The Department for Work and Pensions. Although I was not the creator of the Department for Work and Pensions, I think it's a very, very good example of where machinery of government change is justified. And then we should take the machinery of government, the process of decision-making, seriously, because actually it's a very, very difficult thing to do. Now, our favourite example of how the machinery of government cannot be taken seriously currently might be that the current cabinet, the present government's cabinet, which sits at the apex of the system. We're not arguing that the cabinet should be the decision-making body that accepts really in the most crucial points, but it is actually at the apex. It's the thing that symbolises the sort of system we have. It has 22 members and 11 others who are allowed to attend. So that's 33 people in the room before you get the note takers. Then you get all the people who sit at the back. I've done this, and it's going to be about 40 plus people. Now, this is not a serious way to conduct government. You may say it's trivial. I think we'd say it's a symbol of something that's rather deeper. And if we're going to think about the process of decision-making properly, we need to establish proper machinery for this. This machinery, in our view, we might say we would say this because we're mainly former civil servants, should be in the hands of the civil service, working to ministers, responsive to ministerial needs, but a professionally organised function to provide the support they need. So that's the sort of things we think, which are so obvious, really, sorts of things we think that should go with running an effective government. Some of them are in place, some of them are not. If I just say a few words about the civil service. The civil service obviously has got a number of weaknesses. Although we're ex-civil servants, we're not sitting around defending the civil service's present competences or its fitness of purpose, to use the phrase of a former minister. What we are saying is that it has a key role to play in managing decision-making on behalf of ministers, that it is a key contributor to policy development, not a monopoly provider of policy, but a key contributor to policy, and also responsible for ensuring the integration of policy and delivery. And in doing all of that, there obviously are weaknesses in how it works at the moment. There are weaknesses in its policy skills. There are weaknesses in its delivery skills. There are weaknesses which arise, we think, from a system for deploying civil servants around the system, which is essentially a sort of quasi-market in jobs. We've moved away from an over-rigid system of centralised control of who goes where and does what to a market. This market has massive market failures in it, and these market failures, driven by external internal competition, lead to far too much turbulence in the system and a lack of continuity. And ministers rightly complain about this, and it's up to the civil service to organise itself to put it right, which is both a matter of management and also a matter of thinking about incentives. If the civil service is going to deliver the functions that it needs to deliver, then in our view you have to have a different relationship between ministers and the civil service to the one which appears to have emerged over the last few years. I wouldn't say it was a strikingly wonderful relationship under the previous government, although some of us work with fabulous ministers like Lord Faulkner. See my memoirs shortly. The relationship there was not great. The relationship under this government has at times been very poor. It is not a way to motivate people to stab them in the back in various ways and to blame them for things over which they have only limited control. We could talk about this for hours. I'm not going to. What we say is we need a new compact between ministers and the civil service, which is not about accepting current levels of civil service performance. It's about driving the civil service forward to perform better, but in a context, as I say, like any successful organisation, a context of mutual trust. So if we step back from this and we say, well, you know, we've got this system, how might we improve it? What is very striking is how a lot of the criticism of the system comes up with a solution that what we actually need to drive this forward is an injection of new blood, which is under ministerial direction, selected by ministers, and under their control, operating in parallel to the way in which the system itself is currently structured. So according to taste, you can find you want more new political advisors, more delivery experts, some civil servants wrapped up in what is in the jargon called extended ministerial offices, for a reason I'll come on to in a minute, reporting to ministers directly so they can call their shots, the minister's shots, that is, working on their behalf. We think that if this is the future, it's not a great place to go. it looks as though it might definitely lead to more omni-shambles on a whole new scale. It is a recipe for confused accountability. It's a recipe for a lack of legitimacy in government. It is a recipe that marginalises those ministers in departments probably who are at a junior level, and would eventually, I think, prompt the question, why are we having this great system under the control of the Secretary of State and also all these junior ministers? Perhaps we could at least dispense with some of them. So if we're going to have a French system of cabinets, let's have a French system of the number of ministers in the government. It would fundamentally weaken the personal interaction between ministers and officials. And those of us, Robin and I, spent a lot of our life in that particular game, in inverted commas. And for a civil servant to deal directly with ministers, to get into the minds of ministers, to be able to do what ministers want, is actually what they want to do. They don't want to have all this stuff at second and third hand. Lastly, it would absolutely, if taken to big lengths, absolutely disrupt the way government works, because these teams of ministers and their coterie of advisers will, as they go around the system, as ministers are posted and so on, they'll take this little group with them in their caravan, fetch up in a new place, and so we'll be undermining one of the things we most need to try and improve, which is to get more continuity. Now, what I think is very interesting about this is this idea has been around for so long. As a sort of almost the end of what I'm going to say, for those, I don't know how many of you have read Chris Mullin's diaries. I don't get paid for recommending them, but they're absolutely wonderful. On the 5th of March 2002, he even says nice things about me. On the 5th of March 2002, there is an entry which goes like this: Supper with Alan Milburn and Mike O'Brien. Alan was scathing about the civil service. Everyone thinks they are white knights and that we are the villains, whereas the truth, which we all know, is that many officials are useless. Alan says he favours a cabinet system, such as they have in France, where a minister brings in his own team to run a department. I reminded him that Tony Benn suggested something similar 25 years ago. Better keep quiet about that, he said. Now, what is interesting about this, the reason why I tell this story is, why are we calling these things extended ministerial offices? What lies behind that careful choice of words? Answer: if we didn't call them extended ministerial offices, we'd have to call them cabinets. And to imply we might have a system of government, I'm a great Francophile myself, but to imply we might have a system of government that imported something from France is obviously political death. Now, that's not the reason why I'm opposed to it. I'm opposed to it for the opposite reason. I'm a Francophile who has seen the way the French government works, and I know, and I think there's plenty of evidence, of what would work better. So these are some of the concerns we have. Now, they're not... I'm not going to go through all the others because I'm out of time and we're very conscious of the timetable. But what we're saying is, let us think about the nature of the problem. Let's all read Tony King's book. Let's ask ourselves what would avoid mistakes. Let us not create a system of government in this country which is more prone to omni-shambles than the two we've had since that term was coined. And if you have time to read the rest of our recommendations, you'll see that there's a whole series of stuff about how a new government could make, going to the point about a good start, how a new government could make a good start essentially by keeping things simple, prioritising a smallish number of things, and excellent preparation. We wrote all of this a few months ago. If the preparation hasn't been done, we may be heading in some directions for more omni-shambles. Thank you.
Thank you, Richard. Well, now, the question for Charlie and for Dominic is how much of this chimes with their experience and what they know about the way their party is going to approach it. Charlie, would you like to go first? You're on the starting block. So
thank you very much indeed. I'm really delighted to be here. Christopher Foster over there, I'm very glad to see, who's been driving the Better Government Initiative for a very long time. I'm also delighted to see Robin and Richard. Robin was the cabinet secretary at the point that Labour took power in 1997, and a combination of Robin as the cabinet secretary and Alex Allen as the principal private secretary to the prime minister led the Labour government to have the most favourable view, and I say this genuinely, imaginable, of the civil service. If you meet people of the quality of Robin and Alex, then you think these are the greatest human beings in the world. Richard, an equally great human being, I'm absolutely clear. I had the privilege of working very closely with Richard in the Department of Transport, Local Government of the Regions, as it was then called. It wasn't called that for very long. We were there for a year, and I think we both left on the day that the Department of Transport, Local Government of the Regions blew up completely.
That was my great success.
It was a great success. I remember, I mean, Richard is, and both Robin and Richard have a quality of genuinely brilliant leadership, and they do provide proper leadership for the civil service, or the bits of the civil service that they were leading at the time. I remember having a conversation with Richard when I arrived at the Department of Transport, Local Government, the Regions, in which I said, oh, well, you know, there's a reforming agenda for the civil service, and I think junior ministers, including myself, have been given some responsibility in relation to this reforming agenda, and Richard leaned forward and said, yes, I completely agree with every single aspect of the reforming agenda in the civil service. Indeed, so much do I agree with it, Charlie, that every single step has already been taken, so nothing is required to be done in the Department of Transport, Local Government, the Regions. There was a man, I thought, who could provide real leadership. Can I talk very briefly in response to what Richard has said about preparing for government and not making mistakes, a little bit about the landscape in which any government that takes over will come in. We are in a political landscape where there is identifiable disenchantment with politics and politicians. There is considerable fragmentation in relation to the political scene, see the SNP and UKIP. There is also a sense that coalition equals betrayal, see the response to the Liberal Democrats as a result of entering into coalition. Secondly, the economic position has been poor, albeit is recovering to some extent now, over the last 7 years. Thirdly, the international position is extremely troubled, both in relation to the European Union, the Middle East, and beyond. Fourthly, the domestic security position is unstable in the context of what may happen in relation to people returning from ISIS. Fifthly, in relation to public service, there is a sense of the two major public services, education and health, particularly health, being politically contested. That is an extremely difficult landscape in relation to which any government which takes over will take over. I think the big message in relation to transition is to keep the things that you are doing in relation to transition simple. I find the work that Richard and Christopher and the BGI have done in relation to what should be done to improve the process of government very, very good. I agree with lots of it. It falls foul of one of the principles which Richard and Christopher and the others are urging on a new government, which is keep it simple. I don't mean that some of the points aren't simple. They are pretty simple, but there's just so many of them. And you think to yourself, well, if we've got to sort of transform everything like that, we'll never get there. Can I tell you what I think the things to focus on are? First of all, the position of the centre of government, in particular in relation to its relationships with departments. I completely agree with Richard's analysis that the centre has got to provide the strategic direction for the government. It should not micromanage individual departments, but it has got to provide what the government stands for. It has got to identify the five or six key policies upon which the government will be judged, and it has got to be able both to explain those policies to the outside world, to ensure that those policies are driven through government, and to ensure that as the government goes on over a period of time, those policies remain on track. What does that mean in practice? It means that the centre of government has to have the capacity, first of all, to evaluate the formulation of policy. That means it has to be sufficiently skilled to be able to say no to the Lansley Health Bill. It's also got to be able, after any change is introduced, to make sure that the implementation of that change is being properly monitored from the centre and the centre can intervene if it's going off track. And thirdly, it has to have the capacity and the strength, both politically and administratively, to ensure that the interconnected aspects of policy can be coordinated in effect from the centre. The issues that I've identified, for example, the security issues, the economic issues, the international issues, all require cross-governmental working. If you do not have a centre that is both politically strong and administratively strong, then you won't get the coordination that you require in relation to it. For example, in relation to addressing if one of your aims and one of the aims of the new Labour government would be to upskill the economy, to reduce a low-wage economy, to build the infrastructure, in particular transport and housing, and these are all linked in a particular way, those issues cross BIS, the Treasury, the Department of Communities and Local Government, the remains of the department that myself and Sir Richard Mottram were able to blow up in a variety of ways. These cross-departmental issues need, in effect, to be driven by the centre. I don't mean that you don't take proper advice on the detail and you don't leave the departments to implement their bit of it, but unless there is a coherent aspect and story and direction of policy which has got to come from the centre, then it won't happen. So the first message is the centre has to be strong enough to provide both the political and the administrative direction. Secondly, there need to be institutional relationships between Her Majesty's Treasury and Number 10 that mean the Treasury and Number 10 are working closely together conspicuously. The two elements of that, in my view, are first of all, there has to be transparency of information and advice coming from the Treasury to Number 10 and from Number 10 to the Treasury, so that the Chancellor and the Prime Minister are in equal, they have an equal hold and view on what the position is in relation to the advice and the figures that have been given, so that there is a genuinely joint view in relation to what the correct steps are in relation to the economy. It is the economy and what happens to the economy may well be the defining aspects of whatever government takes power after the general election on the 7th of May. It is interesting that we are fighting a general election now in some respects on the basis of the decisions that were made between, I can't remember the date, in May 2010 and about 20 or 21 days after that. So there being a proper administrative link between the two to promote political union between the two is of absolutely critical importance. Now, I believe from my own close connection with what's going on within the opposition that there will be a very close link between the two at the top, but it needs to be reinforced by institutional arrangements that can actually ensure that degree of transparency between Number 10 and the Treasury, which means that when there are discussions going on between the Chancellor and the Prime Minister, they both have equal access to information and they both have a shared view of the advice they're getting. They may be able to reject the advice that they are getting, but they've got to be getting the same advice in relation to it. The fourth thing is relationships with the civil service. Anybody who has been in government for any length of time knows that success, and Richard said this, completely depends upon genuine partnership. And there has to be a partnership between the civil service and the politicians. The key element in relation to that is trust between the two. Trust depends, I believe, on the politicians being clear about what they wish to do, and then the civil service giving advice as to whether They think there are administrative, economic, or other problems in doing it. Once the advice has been given and properly absorbed, a direction of travel and policy then agreed, which the politicians will trust the civil servants to deliver. My experience of government is that, in fact, quite contrary to the yes minister caricature of the civil servant, the civil servant is keen to deliver and oblige the ministers for whom they work. The problems tend to arise when there is political disagreement about what should be done, which can then lead to factions growing up within a government and, as it were, civil servants working against other civil servants in effect on behalf of their political masters. Alternatively, where there is a lack of clarity, not political problems, about precisely what it is that the minister requires. Now, I do not live in a starry-eyed world where I believe that every civil servant is absolutely excellent. I don't believe that that's the case. I believe that the institution is an institution of huge quality, which has first-class leadership, and you will not go anywhere else in the country and find an institution which, looked at as an institution, is of that quality. We, therefore, as an incoming government, need immediately to send out the signal that we can only succeed if we operate in partnership. That means being clear about what our goals are and all pointing in the same direction. It means that we need to get good, sensible advice. The quid pro quo is that if we give that clear sense of direction, and after we've listened to the advice as to why it may or may not be a good thing, once we've given the signal, then the signal is delivered upon. So partnership, equality, mutual trust is really important. Equality, by equality, I don't mean, and I'd like to make this absolutely clear, we are the masters, not the civil servants, but equality in terms of the quality of the advice that we get has got to be treated entirely on its merits in relation to it. The fourth issue is the one that Richard touched upon. Richard was persuasive, powerful, but I think wrong in relation to the question of extended ministerial offices. It is not a bad thing that a politician, when he takes office as a Secretary of State, should be supported by people who can bring something to his political project in relation to the individual department. If there are people who can, for example, communicate what he wishes to either the outside world, to the civil servants, or to the press, that's a good thing. If there are people with particular expertises in management or in managing the particular topic or are experts in the area where the minister is, it is, in my view, a sensible thing that the minister can come in with that assistance. Ministers are like the civil servants in some respects. Some are absolutely brilliant. Some are absolutely terrible. Most of us in the middle are people who would do well being helped by people who can support us in areas where we aren't strong. For example, communication. For example, if you're not an expert on health service delivery systems or IT systems, if that be the big problem in a department at a particular time, why not bring in somebody who can help you in relation to that? The civil service are fantastic, but they would not claim to be a grouping of experts on every topic. And think of it as well from the point of view of the minister arriving. If you arrive, as it were, you've got your junior ministers, and the world is not going to change. Junior ministers are selected sometimes because of their extreme suitability for the particular job, and sometimes they're selected because there will be political balancing that has to be done. So the system will only ever function on the basis that the ministers are not necessarily the people best suited to deal with the particular problems of a particular department, and they will be moved around a lot. If you've got a strong agenda about a particular part of government as an incoming government, then supplement your ministers with people who can help them. The alternative is the minister comes in, there are difficult management issues, there may well be difficult policy reasons why a particular thing can't be done. They could be got over if you could get a wider breadth of advice. Why not do it like that? Why be so restrictive as to say extended ministerial offices or cabinets or, you know, agents of omni-shambles as the way that Richard tried to describe it. It's a wrong approach to say ministers should not be supplemented in relation to it. Richard identified two particular problems that he said might promote omni-shambles. He said, first of all, it might damage the relationship between the permanent secretary and the minister. That relationship depends upon the secretary of state and the permanent secretary. There is absolutely no reason why, if you are supplemented by a larger team that would be currently acceptable, that the secretary of state cannot and should not have a relationship between the permanent secretary and the same sort of relationship as Richard envisages. What Richard is really getting at, I think, is that a trend is visible whereby the secretaries of state, this has nothing to do with Labour or Tory, it applies to all parties, where the secretaries of state, instead of relying heavily on the permanent secretary, relies much more on a special advisor or a particular advisor. And I don't think that's got anything to do, ultimately, with the idea of extended ministerial offices. It's to do with the sense of confidence that exists between the individual permanent secretary and the individual secretary of state. I believe that that relationship is an absolutely key relationship. It should be seen as one that is preeminent in ensuring a successful ministerial period as a secretary of state, but I don't think it leads to the conclusion that you don't have extended ministerial offices. The second objection that Richard had was, well, what does it do in relation to junior ministers? Well, as long as you identify the extended ministerial office as supplementing what the secretary of state does, I don't think it in any way excludes the junior ministers. The junior ministers are there very much to deal with political issues. Sometimes they're there to deal with administrative issues. I can remember some, as it were, number twos in departments who genuinely were the administrative head of the department running the department whilst the Secretary of State did bigger politics. Sometimes the number two just appeared in Parliament. Sometimes the junior ministers didn't do anything at all. But again, that's not going to be affected by extended ministerial offices. That depends upon the Secretary of State's ability to forge a political team through his junior ministers. So the way I see the key things that we need to be thinking about is, one, a centre that is strong and can give the government direction. Two, institutional arrangements to support a good relationship between the Treasury and Number 10. Three, a mutually trusting relationship between the civil service and the politicians. Four, an acceptance that in certain cases it will be sensible for the politicians to bring supplements with them in the extended ministerial office form. That should not affect either their relationship with the permanent secretary or their relationship with junior ministers. In relation to the points that Richard made, apart from the extended ministerial office where we disagree, he said success depends on a team effort inside departments. I agree with that. He said that the right relationship between the centre and the departments is critical. I agree with that. He said that the centre should define the strategy and not micromanage the departments. I agree with that. He said that we should recognise that all issues are interconnected. I agree with that. He said we should do evidence-based policy rather than policy-based evidence. I completely agree with that. He said that we shouldn't have machinery of government changes. On that, I think that what he was saying, though he didn't say this, but I think I sense this is what he was saying, you shouldn't have machinery of government changes unless you can identify a machinery of government change that will in fact improve delivery by central government. So you're saying don't have machinery of government changes that are just for political purposes. Do it if there, and I agree with that, which means that there would be I think that very few machinery of government changes, but there might be some. He said, have a proper process of decision-making. Of course, I agree with that. He referred to the current cabinet having 22 members and 11 people who attended and lots and lots of others who just sort of hang around in relation to that. I am not sure that the key question is how many attend on a Tuesday morning. And I think the key question within government is what is the relationship, first of all, between the centre, and that means both the Treasury and Number 10, and individual departments, and secondly, how do you cluster the various departments into making interconnected decisions? I wouldn't particularly focus on who turns up on a Tuesday morning. So we don't agree on everything, but we agree on most things, and I go back to where I started. If you can identify three or four things, and I think that we have, which you've got to do to make government work right from the start, that's the key thing, because your first point, a good start, is going to be absolutely critical what's coming. Because call me controversial, but I'm not sensing out there a sense that a landslide is coming. Thank you very much.
Dominic, a conservative view.
Well, I started this by getting quite worried as I listened to Charlie, because I begin to see the makings of a grand coalition. So far as his analysis is concerned as to what the priorities of government are going to be, I think mine chime entirely with his. I simply wrote back on my back of the envelope, how to keep the United Kingdom in the EU through a referendum, how to keep the United Kingdom together, how to avoid World War III, and how to address continuing economic recovery, along with bread-and-butter issues of health, welfare, and education. And I suspect that is going to take up most of the government's time, apart from those things which are unexpected. But actually, as Charlie went on, I started to disagree with him, and I'll come on to the points where I find myself in slight disagreement. I should say at the outset that I obviously come from this from a very biased angle, because alone of virtually any cabinet rank minister, I worked in a government department that has no special advisers, is almost ruthlessly depoliticised in some ways so as to avoid the law officers being contaminated with political decision making, and my goodness, doesn't the system work well? Indeed, I would say that the relationship I built up over the 4 years with the civil servants working in my albeit tiny department, every time I sat round informally having a cup of coffee with cabinet colleagues, I could only marvel at their apparent misfortune, because it was a world that I simply was not experiencing. On the contrary, what I experienced was working with a dedicated team of highly intelligent and knowledgeable individuals who, and I agree entirely with this, started quite quickly, once they realised what it was you wanted, to build a relationship of loyalty and trust, which sustained one through most difficulties. And on top of that, when there were problems which were outside our area of competence, we have a tried and tested method in the Law Officers Department to go in and get external advice from people who are outside of government to help us make the right decision. It almost sounds too good to be true, and I think in some ways, perhaps in the context of overall government, it is. But I think it is noteworthy that this system does appear to work well, because it certainly made me realise that the competences necessary to do what is an important government department, albeit a small one, were all present, and of course people rotate in and out of the Law Officers Department anyway. But I have to accept, looking at many of my colleagues, that a lot of them were in a state of apparently great frustration, that they could not get delivery of their aims and ambitions, and at times complained that the civil service were obstructing them. Although it did strike me, picking up the point which I think both Robin and Richard were making, that in many cases they were failing in their basic duty to their civil servants, in pushing the blame for failure onto officials, when in fact, and I certainly agree with this, The blame lay squarely on them for failing to focus adequately on the problems of delivery, or indeed the problems of presenting their policy clearly in the first place. There is, however, I think, a bit of an irony with all this, because unless I'm wholly mistaken, and obviously I wasn't around before I went into government in 2010, but for the first 18 months to approximately 2 years, the mood music I picked up as I wandered around the corridors at Number 10 from senior civil servants was how astonished they were that cabinet government seemed to have been restored. And there's no doubt that for a period, that was effectively what happened. I don't think it was really about the number of people around the cabinet table. Even then it was rather large. But because of the nature of the coalition, because of the Prime Minister's lack of control over certain cabinet members who were essentially there because of the Deputy Prime Minister's behest, and therefore there wasn't that usual sense that one expects of people wishing to echo each other's point of view, I thought the cabinet as a forum for debate and discussion, in fact, for a period, proved to be quite astonishingly lively. And that does suggest to me that, in fact, you can have successful cabinet government. But I also accept that after about 2 years, as some of the pressures built up on government, the system started to subtly change. There was a magical moment where I remember actually giving a speech where I said that I could think of less populist government in my lifetime. And I discovered to my amusement that this view was echoed in Number 10, except they took a different approach to this as to the direction of travel they felt they ought to be going in compared to the plaudit which I was giving to the government system. And indeed, after that, it did start to change. The coalition parties started to caucus. I think the Liberals had always had a caucus meeting before cabinet, but we started having political cabinet meetings. And it also became clear that a lot of the decision-making was once more disappearing, I think, into the Prime Minister's office, where I historically it had certainly been for a long period before 2010. I suspect, and I should make this clear, there was also a lot of decision-making in the Prime Minister's office even before this change. But certainly the role of the cabinet and the ability to have an informed discussion seemed to me to become more problematical. I certainly agree on what governments need for a good start. The question is whether there's an opportunity to get it. I mean, looking back on the creation of the coalition, actually, I don't think it made a particularly bad start. I mean, there were some egregious howlers in the coalition agreement. How anonymity for rape suspects ever crept in and then had to be removed when both parties suggested that it was that the other party that had insisted on putting it in the first place was one of the more the odder details. And I certainly think that what came out of that for me was that the coalition document was too long. It should have been confined to a much more limited set of agreements, and then the rest, quite frankly, could emerge by negotiation while government was being conducted, instead of which we got ourselves, I think, rather saddled with some micro-issues which were absolutely no consequence, and then eventually we had to abandon and try to find an explanation as to why they should go. Where I disagree with Charlie, and I suppose it's coming back to my point earlier, is I do have serious doubts about whether ministerial cabinet or cabinets are in fact going to be of use. Now, I want to emphasise, I'm coming back to the point I was making earlier, of course there is merit in ensuring that secretaries of state have access, particularly to the ability to discuss informally problems outside of an immediate civil service setting. Quite apart from anything else, they've got to stay sane. And however nice their civil servants may be, or wise, the ability to bounce ideas off other people is important. But if you start to turn this into a structure which effectively, and I think will, push your permanent civil servants out of the picture, and I think it will happen however hard you try to do it, Charlie, or an incoming Labour government will try to do it, I think you start ending up with trouble, because that's exactly where I saw the trouble on each and every occasion that it came across my desk, or indeed on the one or two occasions when I ended up in serious collisions with cabinet colleagues. Because it was quite apparent to me that the real failure that was taking place was in fact a failure within their departments to give the minister concerned sensible advice. So they went off under political pressure on a frolic of their own, which ended up with my having to step in and stop them when it should never have happened in the first place. And I do worry how that sort of mood music can build up and then creates the omni-shambles, which is precisely the thing you want to avoid. Now, I don't want to speak as long as Charlie. I want some time for discussion. But I was going to end on this rather depressed note when we come to the issues facing the next government. One of the reasons why I think Charlie and I absolutely agree is I think that never, certainly in my lifetime, has faith in the political system been at a lower ebb. I can't think of a period where this has happened. Looking around at the Scottish referendum, the rise of UKIP, all the signs are there that public unease and discontent, not so much with politicians, although it does spill over onto us as well as individuals, but about the system, has been greater. And yet, the interesting thing about it is that a form of politics, which is the public face of politics, and which is essentially presentational and about the marketing of a product, has now been the norm for 20 years, perhaps a bit longer, and it's failing. And yet the interesting feature is that although it is so manifestly failing, the leading politicians of all the main political parties have not got a single clue of how to break loose from it. Indeed, far from breaking loose from it, you only have to watch on a daily basis what has been going on for the last 3 months to see that, in fact, we are continuing in exactly the same way. And I do wonder if this is not ultimately going to be the undoing of all of this, because until or unless somebody in one of the mainstream parties decides to break the mould and approach the presentation of politics to the public in a very different way from the way it's being presented at the moment, all the drivers for undermining all these excellent recommendations that you've put forward are going to be there. And indeed, they are going to be in growing intensity. And that is a solution which is outside your control as individuals, as civil servants, ex-civil servants, or for that matter, probably, as the Institute for Government. And I don't know what the answer to that is. But it does seem to me that whoever does break that mould will probably reap the benefits. And in fact, British governance will be markedly improved as a result. Thank you.
Well, I'd like to thank both Charlie and Dominic for two absolutely first-class and fascinating presentations. Now, we know we have got to lose Charlie because he's got a meeting to go to and he'll slip off for anything that he does. But don't worry, contributions from the floor, we will make quite sure he gets a record of so that he doesn't escape them. So now, may I throw it open to the floor? There is a roving microphone. If you'd like to raise your hand and say who you are, and you're free, please, to comment or ask questions. But if they're comments, quite short, please. Yep.
Well, I can't give you the point I disagree with. It's slightly different for a second. But I thought one of the things, the machinery of government changes, I mean, such an essential thing that often causes a lot of problems. And I think exactly the argument having sort of them through, though I think we probably kind of support them through in public as well as in private before engaging them. And we sometimes create this that I think it's kind of there's such big problems for government that they cause such a lot of problems. I did really like the point about churn of civil servants. It's the thing that we get most of when talking to ministers, that deep frustration that I like my civil servants, but they've suddenly gone and replaced almost Daphne-going alike with a new person. And how do you, I think the central theme that we've been thinking about goes back to that strength of the centre, and not a centralising, decentralising theme, but actually what are the responsibilities of the centre for creating effective government, certainly setting direction for the government, completely
completely on the join between Treasury and Number 10. I've worked on both sides of that join, and I have been under orders from both sides of that join not to make it work. And under different political circumstances. So just how you actually
Sorry.
Manage that is quite
yep.
a fascinating question. But also, some of the things that join across government go beyond policy. The effective delivery of government priorities, the effective creation of civil service. We've started to see in the Cabinet Office things like the commercial side of government coming under a strong functional lead to say this is a way of organising and creating capability across Whitehall. We've been 40, 50 years since at least Fulton trying to crack that nut. Treasury have retaken control over the finance function, making that effective throughout government. Whether they'll succeed or not will be interesting, but they have actually taken that role seriously in a way that I haven't seen, certainly in the last 10, 15 years. I've got just one on, I have to touch on extended ministerial officers. We did put forward and have supported for a long time greater support to ministers in discharging their job, and that I think goes beyond simply having civil service support there. Very much in line with what Chad said. But I think we put that recommendation alongside 12 or 11 other recommendations about how you strengthen accountability in the civil service and create clarity about the role of the permanent secretary, as well as creating that additional support to ministers to hold the civil service to account. So I think it has to be read in that space. And the thing I'd be most concerned about pursuing extended ministerial officers, they already exist. I can name, we can all name people in all governments who are effectively in those roles already. There is no transparency or accountability around that. For the politicians, it's vital that there is clarity about what the role is for anyone who's been brought in, why those people have the expertise to discharge it. Otherwise, this system will very quickly descend into something that, as Dominic said, I don't think any politician in the UK wants that they are isolated from the departments which they are trying to lead, which occurs in quite a lot of cities. It's not just the French who have this sort of system.
I know.
But, you know, there's quite a lot of that disengagement. So getting this balance right is really, really tricky, but transparency has got to be at the heart of that. And a commitment from the political side, I think, is that transparency, because otherwise it will be a self-defeating
Julian, thank you very much. Excellent voice. Now, I suspect that was Charlie's call summoning him. So, would you like to comment?
Yeah, I would. That was very interesting. I mean, I agree with a great deal of what you say in relation to how it would go. One thing I was really interested in, and it was slightly bewildered me, is what is the minister, the Secretary of State, to expect from his permanent secretary? Or her permanent secretary. I thought, when I became a Secretary of State, that what my permanent secretary, he or she would be there all the time, and that he or she would be basically going through exactly the same sort of travail that I was going through. So if I was having trouble abolishing the role of Lord Chancellor, then he or she would be having trouble abolishing the role of Lord Chancellor. If I was having difficulty because I couldn't build enough houses, then he or she would be having the same difficulty. And it was sometimes like that, but it wasn't, and other times it wasn't like that. So sometimes you'd have a conversation with your permanent secretary in which he or she would say, yeah, well, let's do this or let's do that in the face of your immediate political difficulties. And other times, he or she would say, well, that does sound pretty troublesome for you.
challenging.
I've got to spend the next 3 days interviewing for the role of Director General of the Widgets Department. And nice to see you. And so if you think about what the pressures are on ministers, I agree that you want your permanent secretary to be the person who both can advise you, but also can make the levers work for you in relation to the development of policy, the dealing with other departments, ideas about what you should be doing. And you don't really quite know what you're going to get. So I agree with you, there's got to be clarity about the people who come within the extended ministerial office as to what they are doing. But you also, as a permanent secretary, need to send, in very many cases, a much clearer signal about what you see your role as a permanent secretary to the minister. Are you just the chief civil servant administering all the other civil servants, or are you my main advisor?
Yeah, absolutely.
The second, yeah. Dominic.
I was just going to come back on the point about machinery of government change, because, I mean, on that I entirely agree with you. I mean, my own experience of machinery of government change was that, I mean, my small department was subject to a potential machinery of government change concerning the Serious Fraud Office and whether it should be moved into the new National Crime Agency. Nothing wrong in having considered that. It was a perfectly reasonable proposal to examine. But what I must say did trouble me about it was that the consideration took far too long, thereby damaging and undermining the ability of the office to maintain its morale and its credibility. And actually, the evidence-based part of it was rather short, and quite frankly, once it was done, was perfectly crystal clear as to why the move was not going to generate any added value, and I was pragmatic about it. But thereafter lingered as a political project that somehow couldn't be abandoned for far too long. And, I mean, there again, I think, I mean, there are two ways of looking at it. One is, at what point should the civil servants have stamped their feet collectively? Because I actually think there was a lot of unanimity of view and said to their ministers, what's the point in this? Rather than allowed it to run. Or what, to what extent do you blame the politicians for simply the thing just going on and on and on? But that's the lesson I drew from that, was not that it was wrong to consider machinery of government, but that you have to do it in a structured way, and you have to make sure you do it very much aware of the damage it starts to create around it the longer it lasts.
Richard, could I just make a point, just going back to what Charlie was saying, about the role of the Permanent Secretary, because I've always seen the role of the Permanent Secretary to figure out what it is the Secretary of State really likes doing, and then ask himself or herself, what is the totality of everything that the department needs to be doing, and how do they best complement the Secretary of State? So it might well be, actually, that you don't spend your time sitting alongside the Secretary of State, giving the Secretary of State policy advice, but your responsibility would be to ensure there is somebody who is senior, who is able to sit alongside the Secretary of State and give them the policy advice. So you are, in a sense, trying to orchestrate the whole machine. This is certainly what I used to try to do, so that the Secretary of State gets what he or she wants and is allowed, because their job is simply impossible, to focus on the things they really care about without there being great gaps in the way the department works. So if you've got a Secretary of State who's got no interest whatsoever in any form of management, just get on with it, you know, and that will take more of your time, therefore. Mm. But don't then say, well, I'm now doing all the management, so Secretary, you've got this political problem? Well, you know, bad luck, mate. That is not the job. And I think the second point I should have brought out more clearly is my concern about extended ministerial offices is essentially that the process, the transparency of the process through which people are appointed, and whether they are or not going to be political, and whether it is going to be a merit-based process. Now, I think that it will end up not being a merit-based process and will become a sort of spoils system, because that's what a number of the players, not you, Charlie, that's what a number of the players are comfortable with. And then you could see how that would open up all sorts of difficulties for the way in which government operates. Just to give a very small example, just think back to the issue of B Sky B, without getting into personalities and so on. In my view, a special advisor in that context was clearly operating in a way that was not appropriate and was not a proper way of conducting government business. Imagine that being multiplied up and people working out, how do I get access so I can just get a better chance on this contract or that contract? Do I go to the civil servants, who in our system traditionally are rock solid, the people who do all this stuff, or do I go to the people who've really got the influence, you know? So I'm really saying there's something about transparency and there's something about merit that we need to worry about.
But, I mean, the B Sky B example, and I agree with what you say in relation to that, indicates the problem is not about whether you have an extended ministerial office, but it is about ensuring that there is proper relationships and proper standards complied with by those who hold positions of influence.
Yes, although I'd never vest any commercial or procurement function in an extended ministerial office out with the control of the Permanent Secretary.
Well, I agree with that, but the surely...
So what are they all going to be doing?
The process of procurement... I mean, well, I don't envisage that they'll be engaged in procurement. Procurement has to be conducted in a way that the external world can see is demonstrably an objective process.
Yep, at the back.
Paul Evans, Barker House Commons. I wasn't going to say anything. Is it working?
Yeah. Don't worry, we can hear. We can hear.
Paul Evans, Barker House Commons. I wasn't going to say anything, but I was provoked by something towards the end of Dominic Grieve's speech to say that one of the missing elements from your programme is Parliament. And I wonder if you might introduce the concept of constructive engagement with Parliament into avoiding omnishambles. And to illustrate another point about the purpose of junior ministers, I often talk to students and they ask me to give an example of when Parliament's ever changed anything. One of my favourite ones, because I happen to be sitting at the table on a Thursday afternoon, was a junior minister, Crispin Blunt in this case, reluctantly pushed into Parliament to announce the implementation of the anonymity for rape suspects policy. And he stood there for an hour and was attacked from behind him, in front of him and beside him, exclusively almost by women. And you sat there and you thought at the end of this, this policy is going nowhere. Mm. We're never going to hear about it again. And a reality check in Parliament can actually be quite useful.
But I certainly think Parliament can be useful. I'm sorry if perhaps we ignored Parliament too much. But Parliament starts to become important when you fouled up. But the foul-up takes place outside of the parliamentary context. My experience is that, on the whole, if you treat Parliament sensibly, Parliament will respond sensibly. If you try to conceal something from Parliament, then it's like a mob. I mean, one moment they're all sort of tearful, and the next moment they're sort of running amok. You only have to look at the way the House of Commons works at Prime Minister's Question Time to see these sort of sea changes in mood taking place in a sort of 10-second period. So you're quite right. Parliament can act as a reality check, and so therefore we should be very grateful. I suppose that's really what we've got Parliament to do. But if you're governing properly, you ought not to need a reality check of that kind. I can only say that I think Crispin probably knew even before he went in to stand up that what he was going in to announce was going to be totally unworkable.
I mean, I speak with diffidence because I'm not and never have been an elected member of the House of Commons, which is where, in effect, the fulcrum of our politics takes place. But the non-mention of Parliament is not because I don't think Parliament is completely central to all of this, but simply because we're dealing with slightly different sorts of issues. As far as the way the constitution of our country works, all of the things about good government are, at one level, designed to obtain the confidence of Parliament. Because if you don't have the confidence of Parliament, one way or another, you will lose office. It's not just obtaining the confidence of Parliament, it's also that Parliament is the place where you've got to be able to convince people that the way that you are going forward is sufficient to not necessarily resolve, but can be delivered in the context of the political differences that Parliament represents. So everything has got to go through the filter of Parliament. Of course, we're talking about a democracy. Of course, the people to whom we address so much is the public at large. But the way our constitution works, and unless you can convince Parliament that what you're doing is okay, you won't last very long. And the anonymity in rape is but one example, which can be writ large to issues like how are you conducting foreign policy or how are you conducting economic policy? Because if ultimately you lose the confidence of Parliament in relation to that, that's the end of it. It might not be reflected in a vote, but it will mean that your authority is gone. And everybody in this room, I'm sure, can think of occasions when authority had gone a long time before a general election. And I have in mind the period between 1978 and 1979, the period between 1995 and 1997, where authority plainly had gone because Parliament was in effect saying, this is an omnishambles.
Yeah. Very, very good way of putting it. Parliament's very much more subtle institution than people from the outside recognise. Yeah. Sorry, Robert.
Robert Hazel from the Constitution Unit and fellow here at the IFG. Can I ask two questions about recruitment? And promotion and transfers and all of that. The first is a comment, really, on what Richard Bottram just said about merit being terribly important if we are to have extended ministerial offices. Some of you will know that we did a two-year project on special advisors and who they are, where they come from, and the like. And one of the things that gradually was brought home to us is how the recruitment is very haphazard.
How recruitment, sorry?
Haphazard.
Recruitment of special advisors is very haphazard.
Yep.
And we concluded that it should be done more frequently on the basis of open competition in order to ensure a merit principle. And so, rather like Richard, if I read you right, Richard, I'd be much more comfortable with extended ministerial offices if these external experts, advisors, etc., were generally recruited following open competition. But my question to you is about recruitment and promotion and transfers within the civil service. You said, and again, it came back to us again and again in the interviews that we did during our Spurs project, where several ministers said to us, actually, I have far more continuity amongst my special advisor team than I do amongst my senior officials, and the churn amongst senior officials is really difficult. Is it possible to ratchet it back? And if so, how? And who's going to do it? And suppose you are back in Whitehall in 2 months' time. Suppose there is a grand coalition, and Charlie and Dominic are your two... There are two senior cabinet office ministers.
I'm ready for my nation's cause.
And they say, Richard, we hear you and we believe you. There is too much churn amongst senior officials. But how are we going to try and bring it back under control? What are your detailed plans that could be made to work in terms of implementation?
Okay. Charlie, first, in case you have to go, and then...
On the first point about recruitment of special advisors, if you are looking for people who are politically in tune with you, which you very often are, I don't think that would necessarily apply to a particular sort of expert advisor, then I think the idea of doing it on a sort of open competition basis is quite difficult, by and large, because political groupings tend to form on belief systems rather than on your writing ability or whatever. So although I hear what you say in relation to the political advisor, I'm not sure that it's particularly practical. I very strongly agree with what you say about the churn of... And actually, it didn't tend to be very senior officials. It tended to be sort of middle-ranking officials. I was infuriated every time I interviewed a civil servant for a job, which from time to time you do as a minister, many of them would often say to me, I would say, you know, why do you want to come and work for me? And I would expect them to say, because you are so wonderful. But they'd always say, well, it's quite a good training opportunity. And I kept thinking to myself, look, is it right that the civil servant should be seeing everything as a training opportunity for the civil service rather than something that might contribute to good government? So I agree with what you say about the churn.
What's Richard going to do about it?
Okay.
I've got to go before I hear. I'm sorry about that. Let me know.
Yes, okay. Yeah. Thanks so much, Charlie. Okay, very, very grateful.
Thank you.
What am I going to do about it? Well, it's a shame Charlie's gone, actually, because I was going to make a point. I'll come to your point in a second. I was going to make a point also about injecting expert advisors into the extended ministerial office or into the department as a whole. This could, of course, be done by the Civil Service Commission under a normal set of rules. You know, so there's no reason for these extended ministerial offices to become a haven of political patronage other than the desire of people to have political patronage. And, you know, let's be honest about this. This is what this is about. It's about, I like the idea that I can get blogs who I know, and Smith, whose mother met me the other day at the Constituency Association, you know, and I exaggerate, you know, I always exaggerate, but you're back then to, you know, pre-Northcote Trevelyan. So a lot of this could be done in a regulated basis under the Civil Service Commission's rules. And then I think you have to change the... In order to do the civil service-y bit, you have to change culture and expectations. I was... just have one anecdote. When I was working in the Ministry of Defence, the Secretary of State for Defence left. I tended to have this effect on people. And his replacement was a guy called Michael Heseltine. And Heseltine said, well, I want to have a choice. You know, so he inherited me. He said, he won't mind me telling you this story, I don't think. But anyway, we won't have it on the record. He said to me, well, I don't really want to inherit you. You know, I want a bit of a competition. So I said, fine, you can have a competition. And then he said, just as Charlie said, he said, and the other thing is, I have discovered from my time in government that essentially ministers are required to train civil servants in private offices, and I am not prepared to train any more civil servants in a private office. So, if you become my private secretary, for all the time I am Secretary of State for Defence, you will be my private secretary. Is that, principal private secretary, is that clear? To which I said, that is absolutely clear. Do you want the job? Yes, I'll take the job, thank you. Now, after about, I've forgotten how many years I did this for, it was quite a while, wasn't it, Robin? You were over in number 10, I think. I can't remember now. But anyway, about 4 years, I think. After about 2 years, the department began to get a sort of, you know, well, you know, blah, blah, you've been doing this for 2 years or whatever, you know, isn't it time for a move or so? I said, well, it's not really time for a move because the Secretary of State offered me the job on the basis that I do it for the whole time he was the Secretary of State, which I proceeded to do. Now, what you could have is you could inject into the system two sets of things. For more senior people, you'd have much more active, using ghastly jargon, talent management. So you would say to people, you are not going to take that job over there because I don't want you to. You don't want me to. I am senior to you in this system. If you take that job over there, I will remember that you took it. You could have rules about how often, how long you have to do in a certain job before you're allowed to move. You could have rules about project management, which I was trying to introduce for many years, which said you can be a project manager doing project X, and as the project grows, you can be promoted as that project manager. So you might do 6-7 years in charge of that project. All these things are feasible as soon as you get out of the idea that these everyone has a self-managed civil service career at public expense. Why should people have a self-managed career at public expense? So, but what we would require is the re-injection of some process and then some quite difficult trade-offs between the interests of individuals and the interests of organisations. But that's what you would do, and a change of culture. So people who moved frequently against the wishes of the management suddenly realised that their career was over. That would get round, you know. I realised I'd blighted my career. How did I blight my career? Oh, I remember, they told me not to do that. There's a black spot now on my file, you know.
And you see that control function sitting in cabinet?
No, I see the control function not sitting in cabinet office. I see the control function sitting for senior people in cabinet office, and then departments would themselves have to much more actively manage their people. In consortia, they could do this as well, you know. But a lot of that, the reason why it's awkward is because people don't necessarily like it. Sorry, it's a very long answer. And also because it's expensive. So if you look at departments, they have got rid of most of their HR functions. Quite extraordinary, you know. A huge department like Defence has virtually no HR function now. This has all been stripped out in the interests of economy and efficiency. This is not in the interests of economy and efficiency. This is the interests of a self-managed system which is very inefficient.
Thank you.
You have to partly reverse it.
But I must say, I do think it was a bit extreme to organise Westland in order to get yourself out of the
Well, you've seen the Republic records.
Dominic, if you want to add.
Of course, my staff rotates. Yeah. And I mean, there's no permanent, well, with two exceptions, there are no permanent staff in the Attorney General's office at all. Did that matter? I was sorry when I lost my first private secretary, simply very good. Not his replacement wasn't very good, but it was two and a half years in, but it was the end of his stint, and he was entitled to go somewhere else. But his replacement actually did a very good job as well. You do build up relationships, and certainly continuity is helpful. And I think if I was giving advice to the AGO, I would say that slightly longer rotations into the Attorney General's office would be helpful. And so to that extent, I think I echo what Richard said.
Thank you. Yes, Lee.
Well, I just really almost want to pick up one thing, a couple of words that, Dominic, you just threw in as an aside there, which, because I've agreed with almost everything else you and a huge amount that Charlie has said this morning, I agree with, but that I didn't. Two and a half years in, your private secretary went because, quote, he was entitled to go somewhere else. And actually, I think for some of us who try to lead huge government departments, this culture of I can go to any job on any day, that suits me because I think it might be a good idea and anyway I need to develop my CV a bit further, has become endemic. And actually, we need to go back to the idea that the civil service is there to serve the government of the day. And if serving the government of the day means that ministers say, actually, you know what? I'd like my private office to remain in place while I remain the Secretary of State. That ought to become what we do. And more widely, it ought to become the norm, not the exception, that people are in post as civil servants far longer. One of the things this present government has absolutely done better than its predecessor, don't start me off on the other side, there are some I think differently, is that the huge rotation of ministers, at least in some departments, has become much, much less. And I think that puts a parallel responsibility on the civil service to keep civil servants in place for far longer.
Well, fine, but that is a matter for the civil service career structure. All I can say is that when he left, he didn't leave, as far as I was concerned, prematurely. It was always quite apparent to me that he would have done that sort of period. And, of course, from the point of view of getting on with his career, that's the time when you need to move. If you think you're going to be penalised by staying too long in one post, that's the point, isn't it? Mm. If you think that, then you're going to be held back. You've been successful as a private secretary, you want to go off and do something else. And there comes a point where if you're not doing it, not making the applications, that may be held against you later on.
Yeah, well, I think that brings out a very interesting point, that, you know, there is a real debate between the minister and the permanent secretary over this sort of issue. Because very often, the interests of the minister, the interests of serving the government, can come up against management issues of the civil service. And these aren't easy things to resolve, but they're very much better resolved by trusting debate than by any other means. We must bring it to an end. It is 2 o'clock. Could I just say three thank yous? I mean, first of all, to Dominic, to Charlie, and really, really, I think, interesting presentations, and Richard, to you. Can I thank the IFG for hosting this, because we, like they, are in the business of trying to make sure government works as well as possible, and it's really nice to work with you. And also Nat LaRue and the Constitution Society, who make a great contribution to the work that IFG do. So may I thank you all, and so I think it's been a really good session.
Thank you. Very enjoyable.